welcome back to A Youthful Take. We're not going to do a news section today because we have a really long and great interview that kind of stands alone, so we'll just get right into that. All right, enjoy. Welcome back to A Youthful Take. Today is very special as I'm here with former United States Congressman Ted Deutch. Congressman Deutch served Florida's 22nd District from 2010 to 2022. He chaired the House Ethics Committee from 2019 to 2022, and he's the current CEO of the American Jewish Committee. Thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be with you. Thanks, Sam.
Of course. All right. First question, I like to ask this to all our guests, but how did you get your start in politics? What were some of your inspirations and motivations for getting involved?
Well, I had always wanted to be involved in something where I can make a difference. My dad fought in World War II, and he earned a Purple Heart fighting in the Battle of the Bulge, and he always emphasized the importance of service, and being in politics is not the same as serving in the military, obviously, but it was a way for me to contribute to the country and for me to do something that was really meaningful. And it's been a passion of mine for a long time, going back to when I was in high school. Then in college, I was involved in lots of different organizations advocating for positive change in the world. And then I got to do it in Congress, which was an amazing opportunity.
Mm. What was the election process like? Did you win your first try?
So my first election in fifth grade, is that the one you're asking about?
Well, that and in 2011.
I lost in fifth grade when I ran for president of my elementary school, but fortunately the rest of my elections went well. And I was a student government kid, and I did that growing up and even into college. And then I worked on a lot of presidential campaigns, and I thought that eventually one of my candidates might get elected president and I could go do public service in Washington. And I ultimately decided to run, and I ran in a state Senate race. I ran for a state Senate seat against a very, very well-known incumbent member of the state House. So I was the only person dumb enough, frankly, to think that I could win that race. And I managed to do that and got elected to the state Senate. And 4 years later, my congressman left to do something else. So there was an opportunity to run for Congress, and that worked out well as well. So I was very fortunate in my elections.
Oh, interesting. Battle of the Bulge, your dad, that's crazy. I mean, just learning about that.
It's crazy. I mean, it's 80 years since the end of the war coming up. And I was the youngest in my family of five kids, and my siblings were all a lot older, and my dad was older. And so he had this experience and always wanted to share how important it was, how proud he was to be an American, and how important it was for all of us to recognize what people have done for us, to give us the opportunity to have podcasts like this and to speak freely and live the lives that we're fortunate to live.
Yes. So as I just before, you chaired the House Ethics Committee. Obviously, a lot of that is confidential, but is there anything you can tell us about the duties of the committee and what you did as chair?
Sure. The committee is responsible for enforcing all of the ethics rules that apply to members of the House. And we have jurisdiction. We only have the ability to impose penalties and to review these cases while members are actually in the House. So I was there during the Me Too movement, and there were a good number of members who had some really awful behavior. And this was when Congress, like the rest of the world, stood up and realized that there had to be dramatic change. And there were a number of members that wound up resigning from Congress to avoid penalties from us. But otherwise, we worked to make sure that people were, that that they were treating their staffs the way that they're supposed to make sure that they were handling the taxpayers' money the way they're supposed to make sure that they weren't enriching themselves at the expense of the taxpayers or their contributors. All of the ways just to make sure that people were being respectful of the rules. And unfortunately, there's plenty to do. I was also there during COVID, so all of the people who refused to wear a mask, all of the people who violated the restrictions that were in place wound up coming to the ethics committee. And that was also something that unfortunately took up a lot of time, but all of it just meant to make sure that that we were enforcing the rules so that people in that case could be safe.
Yeah, interesting. What's the version of that in the Senate? Because I know I'm thinking of some cases like Al Franken. And recently, with the New Jersey senator, do they have the same system going on?
So the Senate does. They also have an ethics committee, and the ethics committee is responsible for enforcing rules. When we think the law has been broken, we'll make referrals to the Department of Justice, and sometimes the Department of Justice will jump in to tell us to tell the ethics committee to hold up on the investigation because they're now pursuing it as a criminal matter. And I think that's what you're referring to in the Senate with former Senator Menendez.
So I hear you often stress like the importance of bipartisanship when in during your time in Congress. Can you share any congressman across the aisle from you that you felt shared that same belief and that you worked well with? And how do we promote bipartisanship today when it's as contentious as it's ever been in Congress?
Yeah, it is. Unfortunately, it's contentious. The level of partisanship is higher than I've ever seen it. But it doesn't mean that you can't work together. I spent a lot of time working on foreign policy issues. I chair the Middle East subcommittee. I worked on broader foreign policy and human rights and national security issues. And I had a lot of people across the aisle that I worked with. Ileana Ross Leighton was a member, a fellow colleague from Florida, where I represented. We had a lot in common in the way that we viewed the world and the importance of defending human rights. And I worked closely with her. I worked on the ethics committee, where there's an even number of Democrats and Republicans. It's the one committee where you're forced to work together because otherwise the committee can't get anything done. It's got to be bipartisan. And even in those cases where there might be lots of differences, you still look for ways to get things done. After the school shooting in Parkland, which was in my district, I worked with some Republican colleagues to try to advance legislation to help protect schools. I worked with a Republican colleague, Vern Buchanan, to pass the first ever federal animal rights legislation, the Prevent Animal Cruelty and Torture Act. Again, people have there's this perception that Democrats and Republicans never get along and never work together. But in order for Congress to do anything, you have to find ways to do that. So in some specific areas, I mentioned animal rights and human rights. I worked with closely with Republicans on legislation aimed at making sure that insurance companies took care of people with eating disorders and other mental illness. There's just a lot that gets done that doesn't always get attention, mostly because it's not great TV to put on a Democrat and Republican to talk about how much they enjoy working with one another.
Yeah, I think the insurance that was a good point. I'm seeing that a lot now. I mean, after that, after the I mean the CEO assassination, I think Elizabeth Warren, and I know Josh Hawley is all big on like kind of trust busting with the big insurance companies. But is that, do you know if that's Elizabeth Warren who's also working on that?
I'm not sure who's working on that now. I know, I mean, several years ago when we were working on those issues, there was, there was the way a lot of things work in Congress, there were people who came to see me to who had suffered with eating disorders, and were told there was a real leader in that fight who came to me and said, you know, my doctor would just tell me that I should eat more, and the insurance companies would deny coverage for the treatment that I needed. And because of that, there was a whole movement that built up to that ultimately led to legislation that requires insurance companies to cover these kinds of illnesses. And that you're seeing that same conversation take place. It's an ongoing conversation to make sure that people are able to get access to the care that they need.
When we talked to Congressman Phillips, I know you guys crossed paths briefly in Congress. He said he was working on like a bipartisan caucus where he like 30 Democrat senators and or no, it's congressmen and 30 Republican congressmen would have dinner like monthly. Were you ever a part of that?
I was a part of an effort like that just as it started, and it was helpful because the idea was to be able to go to a meeting and have conversations about the kinds of things that we could work together on, without having to give up on your political views. It wasn't, people came in there with very strong views about who they were as Democrats or Republicans and what their views were on different issues, but always with the goal of trying to find some specific areas that they might focus on. And I think those kinds of conversations are really helpful. I think even in an informal way, when members of Congress can spend time with one another outside of Congress, whether in a social setting, at an event, or traveling together, which is something that I did with my Democrat and Republican colleagues alike, traveling together outside of the country and representing the United States, and in places that they only need to know that the United States has a position on issues that impact them. It's not helpful for them to see divisions. And so it's a great way to actually get to know people that you don't spend a ton of time with in Washington, and at the same time to advance America's interests around the world.
Yeah, interesting. You touched on this briefly already, but is there any like specific pieces of legislation that stick out to you when you're in Congress? Like, oh, I'm particularly proud of that, and that I feel like was a big deal.
I touched on some, but I mean the animal rights legislation, imposing federal penalties for violations of animal cruelty laws, I was really proud of. And but I yes, one of the other things that really mattered to me that I'm really proud of is legislation that I worked on with the family of Robert Levinson. Robert Levinson was the longest held American hostage in history. The Iranians took him hostage, and sadly, he died in captivity. But his family had a really hard time getting the government to pay attention to them, to listen to them. And because of their efforts, we were able to pass the Robert Levinson Hostage Recovery and Hostage Account Taking Accountability Act, which was something that imposed sanctions on countries that take Americans hostage, but also created in the White House a whole group that was focused on working with families of hostages. And it was the right thing to do, and we were proud to do it. But now fast forward to the fact that we're now there's still 100 hostages being held by Hamas in tunnels beneath Gaza for over 440 days. For those families, including American families, there's now someone that they can turn to who's looking out for them, for their loved ones, working to bring them home. That was something that I worked on that I was really proud to be a part of.
Yeah, well, very, very impressive. Very important also. Yeah, well, you kind of just segue to that a little bit, but let's jump to oh, my dogs are barking. Jump to your work now with the AJC. So as I mentioned, I'm a senior in high school. I'm gonna be going to college in the fall, and there's a very good chance that I will be at a place that is prevalent student protests, which sometimes are perfectly fine and sometimes can get violent and almost oppressive. Like, do you have any advice for me on how I can handle that, or in just general for high school seniors that are going to be experiencing that next year?
Sure. I mean, first and foremost, the best response to people who are protesting and who are working, it's not just protesting, but so many of the protests that we saw happen on college campuses weren't protests about the policies of Israel. They were protests against the existence of Israel. And sadly, in a bunch of cases, they were protests in support of the slaughter of over 1,200 people on October 7th of last year. And the best way to respond to that is first and foremost to be proud and to not allow them to dictate what happens on campus. At AJC, we have a campus global board that works of student leaders from around the world who work really closely with other student groups to help lift up the voices of people who are fighting. They're fighting anti-Semitism, and they're really fighting against this effort to silence an entire group. Campuses are supposed to be places where hard discussions take place, and I think that's really important. But when you try to silence an entire group of people, you've got to speak out against that and feel comfortable being who you are and going to the administration and helping them understand why it's so important to make sure that that the Jewish voices aren't silenced, aren't allowed to be silenced on campus.
Are you guys noticing that this semester, on college campuses, like, what extent are the protests happening? I'm sure they're not like in the spring, but how is that go? How's that go?
Well, we worked really hard with university presidents around the country to help prepare them for this academic year. A lot of people just weren't prepared last spring. They didn't know, they really didn't know how to enforce their own codes of student conduct. They didn't realize that the tone that's set on campus for meaningful dialogue and debate means that you can't silence a whole group. So you can have restrictions. People are allowed to protest, but you can have restrictions that say that they can't make it impossible to walk across campus. They can't disrupt classes. They can't give extra credit for encouraging people to take part in activities that they don't believe in. And over the summer, so many campuses really focused on all of the things that they could do to make sure that things went more smoothly this academic year. And for the most part, we've seen changes. There are still campuses where those problems exist, and the universities are focused on them and student leaders are focused on them. But it really starts with making sure that the codes of student conduct are upheld, and that they're doing everything they can to make sure that the campus is a place where everybody feels welcome.
Yeah, I feel like that's really important. I feel like, yeah, I visited UCLA in the spring, right when this was going on, with some of my friends, to just like see what was going on. And it just seemed like there was a crazy double standard, and that there was just no sort of backlash. I mean, eventually it took like a week, but eventually I watched in the news how like the camp got rolled over. But yeah, it just seemed complete chaos, and it was like it was in like a war zone there. It was insane.
Yeah, it was really unfortunate what happened there. And look, the other piece of this is there's a small group that gets out there and basically says that the only country in the world that doesn't have a right to exist is happens to be the one Jewish country, and that the only group that shouldn't be accepted on campus is the Jews. And that's not how most people think. And so you got to push back, I think, really hard against that, and realize that when it comes to what happens on campus, there's an opportunity to actually, really lift up the fact that the facts around what's happening, And especially, and I used to give a lot of talks when I was a member of Congress about how supporting Israel is not something to fit into a progressive worldview. It's fundamental to people, to progressives. It's fundamental to their identity to support the country that actually respects human rights and has civil rights and LGBT equality and free exchange of ideas and democracy, where you see protests on a regular basis, with diversity of Israelis and Arabs and so many people from all around the world who have come to live there. The facts matter a lot, and it's always a good opportunity to help highlight this.
What do you make of Bernie Sanders and his takes on the situation? Because I know, I mean, he's a Jewish man, so I feel like it's very nuanced what he's saying, but like, what do you make of that?
Look, I don't I don't in Bernie's case, I don't think it's I think some of what he said is actually not a lot of what he says is not nuanced at all. I mean, when you come from sort of this fundamental worldview that is opposed to Israel's right to self-defense, it actually makes it harder to it makes it harder to focus on what's going on the ground, the fact that there are still 100 hostages, the fact that Israel's been waging this war of self-defense against seven fronts, Iran and all of the countries that surround it and areas that surround it. And it's actually more helpful, I believe, to if you're speaking with nuance, speak about nuance with what's actually happening in Israel and to reflect the full range of ideas that exist within Israel, instead of trying to impose views that make it harder for Israel to defend itself.
Now we always do this. Moving on, we do some more lighthearted questions at the end.
Great.
So, I mean, obviously, you're a Jewish man. What's your favorite Jewish tradition or holiday?
I really love I mean, I love all of the holidays. I love the one that we have every week. I love Shabbat. I love Shabbat dinner on Friday nights. It with everything going on in the world, having the opportunity just to stop and be together and totally turn down the volume and just remember the importance of family and tradition. It's my favorite. I do love a good Passover Seder and matzo ball soup, but
Passover. I love the idea of Yom Kippur, but then when I fast and then I eat too much, and then I just feel terrible every year at the end of it.
guess what? Doesn't change. That's going to continue your whole
Every
life.
single year that happens, and then you're a Michigan alum. I think I mentioned, I'm not sure if it's on the recording, but I applied to Michigan. I'm hearing back soon. Do you have a favorite Michigan memory or tradition?
Well, I have yes, I have dozens of them, and the memories are great. Starting with the one that didn't happen when I was at Michigan, but the one that happened just this past January when Michigan won the national championship. But I love there is so much tradition on campus at Michigan. I love football Saturdays. I love walking to the stadium with th thousands and thousands of people, and the feeling within the stadium of over 100,000 people, everyone united and cheering for the football team. And it's a Ann Arbor's a it's a great place. It's a great city to be in college, and there's so many unbelievable traditions around Michigan sports and Michigan football in particular that I think about a lot, and I try to get back every year to participate in them even all these years later.
What was Michigan's record against OSU when you were there?
Well, it's not as good as it's been the past 4 years,
That's
I'll tell
great.
you that. We did well when I was there. There was a very long period where I think things were really challenging, but it's been over 5 years since Ohio State last beat Michigan in football, And I don't think anyone saw it coming this year, but it was a great way after last year's national championship. It was a great way to end a season that was challenging this year, and to make it feel a lot better with that big win over Ohio State.
Yeah. That concludes my questions. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
Yeah.